Bar Radio presents. Ian
Molesworth. KSI and Randolph. Are you there, KSI?
Yo, what's up?
So, why are you having fights with people?
Well, I mean, obviously, I got to show that I'm the best boxing YouTuber on YouTube.
What is happening in Brixton?
So we got a show. We got like our, London show.
And what happens in that? Is that all singing and rapping, or is that a bit of fighting and all chucked in for good fun?
I mean, if you punch me, nothing would happen now. I'd just be like, did a fly hit me, or I don't know.
Look at this. I reckon if I keep pushing their buttons in the right way, they'll start fighting each other right now. That'd be all right, wouldn't it? We're joined by Katie Manning now in the studio. You nearly fell off your chair.
I'm very physical. Good. Did you know what I mean? I get very excited. Yeah. And for a woman of my age, that's quite scary.
How old are you? 38-ish?
Oh, you're darling.
Around 38.
I could be your grandma, darling, because I'm 72.
Why could you not be my girlfriend?
Yeah, do you not want to be...
Do you like an older woman, darling?
I like anyone.
Who says yes?
Yeah. No, I don't. No, I'm like, I wouldn't have any...
I just missed my mouth then. That was maybe you should not have me.
That's a good point, actually, isn't it? Phaser is now sat opposite me.
We're all puppets, but I like to pull my own strings.
Yeah, no, I don't think we are all puppets, though.
In the entertainment, you know, like...
Do you really think that?
Punch and Judy type thing.
Do you think? I'm not a puppet.
You can be your own puppet.
I'm not a puppet.
You're not a puppet.
What are you? You are actually a puppet. You had a guess. You've been made into a puppet. He has actually been made into a puppet, haven't you?
It wasn't like a voodoo puppet or nothing like that.
I have a big collection of voodoo dolls at home.
No.
And really, I've been pulling out little teeth recently in them. And you have been going to the dentist. So
I wouldn't be
there.
Surprised if you did have a load of... That actually wouldn't have shocked me. We're joined now by Alex Fox.
I'm not a fan of 50 Shades. Those books are not well loved by many people on the responsible fetish community scene because they depict in many ways a problematic dynamic. Least exciting erotic series that I've seen in a while. I virtually fell asleep watching those films.
But that can happen after a while.
True. If I'm late for anything, it's usually because I've had a wank falling asleep. A fap and a nap, as I like to call it.
Every Monday, Ian Molesworth, from 4 p.m.
You're listening to Food Bar Radio.
Food Bar Radio. Food Bar Radio.
Food Bar Radio.
I'm joined in the studio now by Josh Berry. Hello, man.
Hello.
Is it a tour or is it just...
It's last year's Edinburgh show. Okay. I might tour in the autumn of doing the new show, but yeah, this is...
So what is the show? So what did you do in Edinburgh first of all? Is it exactly the same show?
I mean, some of it's sort of out of date now, unfortunately, because it was sort of politically stuff.
Yeah.
I do a lot of impressions, so it's like...
Okay.
Doing...
Why'd you do
topical.
That?
Why?
Yeah.
That wasn't
confrontational. No. Like, genuine... That's a genuine question.
Why do I do impressions? Yeah. Just a lack of comic skill, really.
I'm honestly not saying it as a slight. Why did that... So you're a stand-up?
Yeah.
So why is that incorporated into your...
I was an impressionist first, I think.
Right, okay,
so I've done them
since
I was really young. And then I started doing stand-up with it. So I would consider myself a stand-up, but, like, yeah, it's sort of embedded in. It's not... Yeah, I mean, it's comedy with impressions rather than these are impressions.
Was that something you did as a child?
Yeah, I did. I used to... The first one I'd learned, I was about 13, and I could do... It was right before my voice broke. I could do Johnny Vegas just going like... Like that.
Yeah.
Before
your voice broke.
Yes.
And then
I rediscovered it. Oh, I couldn't do afterwards for a bit as, you know, the sort of, adolescent voice thing.
Yeah.
And now I've sort of rediscovered that horsey, you know, sort of Johnny
Vegas
voice.
Did you see that? He did a little sneaky Jimmy Savile in the middle
of that. Yeah, got a little Jimmy Savile there, yeah.
Brilliant,
that was actually impressive. He's an easy one to do, actually, Jimmy.
You know, fucking do him anymore.
You know when you said that some of them you won't be doing in this show because they're dated?
Well.
That one's dated very badly.
Prince Andrew's gone. Michael Jackson's gone. All of them.
So your material, is it topical anyway?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, some of it's silly and stupid.
Yeah.
I think it feels like the older you get, the more believable you become in some ways.
Yeah.
I've growing into a comic persona. I was having a chat with a mate the other day, and he was saying that, like, no one cares as a stand-up what you say until you get to, like, 34, 35.
Do you think that's true? But do you think that's still true? I think maybe your peers don't. So maybe people who work in the comedy industry as performers will be like, you kids, you don't know what you're fucking on about. Wait till you're my age, then you'll know. Then you'll have something to talk about.
Right.
And I do get that and relate to that. But that might be also something that just comes with age and bitterness and shit. But but I also think there is a weight of truth to that, and that's been a truism within comedy since time dot, you know, that all the old school comics would have said that as well. Mm. They'd have gone, you know nothing till you're 40.
Mm.
And if you're talking about life, then you've got nothing to say. The other counter argument to that is, a kid has still got something to say. It's just about being a kid.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? So it might be relatable to much older generations.
Sure.
But they've still got something to say. I remember Ewan McGregor saying that thing once where they said that somebody said something about the only people that like Oasis are 13-year-old girls, and Ewan McGregor said, when are we discounting the opinions of 13-year-old girls?
Yeah.
Why is that that important?
Yeah.
You know, right. Do you know what I mean? It's an insult.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To use something against someone that's either an achievement or is just who they are, be that the colour of their skin, what they look like, their weight, whatever it is that you use, it's still an abhorrent and also a very flawed counter-argument, because it's got nothing to do with what they're fucking saying, hasn't
it? Yeah, sure. Mm. That's so popular at the moment, though. Attack the person, not the argument. People do it all the time.
But across all realms. It's not just like olden days. That used to be just the fucking stuffy old right doing that.
Yeah.
Now it's also the left doing that as well, the other direction. It's like, you know, no one can... There's not many of them at the moment can hold their heads high and say, well, we fought a clean fight. It's like, did you fuck? None of you did.
No. But the problem is, if you look, especially places like Twitter, it's such a ground for so much hatred and the worst members of both sides of each.
It's the nature
argument.
Of the battlefield, not the battle. Yeah,
right.
That's what it is.
Exactly.
So because that's constructed, I mean, it wasn't constructed to do that, but because because that's what it has become, how the fight unfolds. And it's just fucking stupid.
Yeah. You find that when you're attacking somebody for age or for race or
do
for
I
gender...
find when I'm attacking someone
when,
for race?
No, when somebody...
That's a big question.
No, when somebody is, like, someone's sexuality or whatever it is, how they look, then you kind of feel like you've lost, or for me, like, the argument's very weak, because if you have to resort to how somebody looks like
But what I wouldn't want to see in society is where that becomes something that you can't even do jokingly with your friends.
Well, that's different, though, isn't it, than doing it on social media?
No, it actually isn't, because... Oh, yeah, then if it's a public thing...
Right, yeah.
Like, I've had it with Dodds, where I've called him an idiot or whatever, or I've said he's fucking mental and all that sort of stuff, and it's like, you can't say mental. It's like, no, I definitely can. I definitely can.
Right.
I have my own mental issues. I definitely can claim that word and use it.
Yeah.
And use it as a joke. And do you know what I mean? I can definitely make fun of his clothes and things like that, because that's within the safety of the professional relationship.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the argument that can knock on to other people going, yeah, but what about people that aren't in that relationship, but those things still apply to? They feel upset by it. Mm. And I get that, but I would hope that my nature of doing it should be tacit what I'm actually doing in that situation. But it's not always. So now, what's happening now is that things that should be tacit are either being deliberately ignored as being tacit. So it's like... Well, case in point, when we talked about Danny Baker, it's like, someone who knew him and stuff like that, sounds like he died, but I knew him back in the day, I was confident that that was not his intent with what he said.
No.
I was confident of it. But an apology wasn't enough. You know, him saying, no, that's not what I meant, I'll delete it, but that's not at all what I meant, wasn't enough. And
well, we've talked about that. In my opinion, it wasn't a proper apology.
Regardless of that,
I'm sorry if you think that I think this way, which is not an apology.
Oh, the Kevin Spacey classic.
Exactly.
Yeah, but how do you apologise something that you?
I'm sorry I did that. I'm sorry I offended anybody. I'm sorry that I put that up there.
That also acknowledges.
Yeah.
You have done something wrong.
Right.
If in your intent you've not done something wrong, and if some people have taken it as meaning something else, that's a whole different kettle of fish. Because you're like, well, how can I apologise? When I've told you what my intent was, that it wasn't the intent you decided it was, but if I apologise, I acknowledge guilt.
Mm.
That's the situation you're in with that. It's a good interview, this, isn't it? It's got nothing to do with your show.
Don't worry about that. But there's interesting points to be made. That is, I think that's an issue now. It's the way that the sort of society seems to play that game. Like, an apology is death. Like, Jacob Rees-Mogg during the election, you know, the stuff he said about Grenfell, when he apologised for that, he was, you know, shunned and sidelined. Whereas Boris Johnson has done stuff, you know, way worse, arguably, than that, and never apologises. It just carries through this endless trail of shit. Yeah, it's the same with Trump. It's just this denial. It's the victimhood
which
status.
Which seems to be the
tactic.
So it seems to be the actual way to win an argument now is to never acknowledge you've lost.
Exactly.
Ever. Even in the face of all evidence, is to never acknowledge it or just say, no, I didn't. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
And
just keep saying it. Right.
And it's a bizarre state of affairs, but I think that has come about because of the gang pylon mentality of social media. That's why that's happened. Mm. It's like, if you engage, you're fucked.
Oh, yeah.
So if you try and engage, you're fucked. So don't engage, deny if you're asked in person and just let it go away.
Sure, sure.
Which means that no one's ever accountable for anything. You know,
although people still do get cancelled, don't they? I mean, cancel culture exists,
only
right?
when like they enter into it. Please talk about your fucking show.
Okay, yeah, fine, if we must.
Well, what do you want? Do you know what do you want? yeah, do you know what?
Yeah, but I don't know. I quite like. I mean, satire's fun in that you get to shit on an idea, and I find that fun. Like, and I feel like there's so much shit in society that people just accept. Yeah. Like television, like Love Island is. I'm not saying it's a terrible show, but just like. People just accept that show, and there's so much stuff that goes on that can be satirized, and I think there's something fun about that. I enjoy doing that.
But I wish you well with your show.
Yeah. Thanks.
I feel like you're going to go away and go, I need to rewrite all of this.
No.
I'm constantly. Don't. It's, you know, half the show's irrelevant now, so.
Well, you're at the Leicester Square Theatre, Saturday, 14th of March,
that
7 p.m.
That is true.
Including support.
1 hour 40
yeah.
with support.
Yeah.
Support. Ooh.
FUBAR Radio presents
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville.
We've got our second guest of the day, and he goes by the name Darren Harriet.
It's nice because you do a show in like an arts festival, and they're much more forgiving. Right. It's arty, isn't it? They're all just like, oh, hello, who's this guy? Let's see what he has to say. Oh, he's from the Midlands, and he's black. Oh, this is different. You know, they relax, and they're, oh, yeah, very nice. But I'm like, hey, what about if I'm in Crawley on a Wednesday? It needs to be a real hit-them-hard show, as opposed to like
Is that the comedy equivalent of a Stoke on a freezing Tuesday night for football?
I was going to say Stoke in my head, but I realised there's no Stoke dates, but I was literally going to say Stoke on a Tuesday.
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville, every Wednesday from 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
We've got in our presence possibly the hottest sneaker collector in the UK. You see the segue there?
You done well.
Thank you very much. I've been practicing. He goes by the name of Kish Cash. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Man.
I did introduce you as like, you know, the hottest, the biggest sneaker collector in like the UK. Wow. But there's so much more to you than that, isn't there?
I'm humbled that you say that, and it's good to see that the checks are still going through. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you know,
man. What I mean? I've changed my dress, by the way, so we're going to talk about that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I wonder. Yo, okay, we'll talk about that for real. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. So it's wicked to be up here, man.
I've not seen who
you've had up here. And it must be a tough week. That's why you got me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, you know, but it's all good.
It's been a slow week for guests. Mm. No, I'm joking. You're a radio presenter yourself. You present a show on Soho Radio.
That's right,
And then that's one of the many strings to your bow, on top of obviously being a sneaker aficionado.
Oh, I like that term.
There we go. Yeah. Should we stick with aficionado?
I like that, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's a good term.
That works.
When it comes to sneaker collecting, mm-hmm. before the sort of culture shifted to like raffles and, you know, like high-end collaborations and whatnot, when it was just a really good fucking pair of Jordans or Air Max, mm-hmm. you were the first name that I heard.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Because I didn't kind of infiltrate the sort of the sneaker scene until relatively late, sort of late noughties, and that was through working in, like, you know, sneaker stores.
Yeah.
And obviously your name came up a lot because of the staff, you know, offspring on Neil Street. So, you know, Debbie,
I worked
Dave.
There. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everyone was like, Kish is the guy. And I remember finding out that you put on or you were asked to contribute to an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
That's right. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
So tell us about that, because all I know about that is that you put forward some of your massive collection.
Yeah, that was a mad trip. I mean, the thing is, right, going from like being in a hip hop and football, and then all these years later, just being asked to contribute to something at the V&A, you're just like, yo, is this for real? But the thing is, there was a Fashion v Sport symposium.
That was it.
Which happened, I think it was about 2005 or something.
It was
like
around
that.
Them times. It was ages ago,
yeah,
wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, feels yeah, like yeah, yeah. Totally. And I was asked to contribute the final room and work out, you know, what are the best sneakers of all time. And I said, well, I don't want to do the best sneakers of all time. I'll do the ones that mean, you know, I think the most significant. Right. Historically, uh-huh, at that uh-huh, point. Uh-huh. And for various different reasons.
Yeah.
And it would look remarkably different if we did that now. But the thing is,
which
to be given that,
true.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, how much would it be Off-White? How much would it be, you know, whatever hot collab? If they asked somebody else to do it, and would it be on that? Some of it would be very valid, of course. You know, and everything evolves. But I tell you what, it was a trip, because you're seeing your stuff in the V&A, which is obviously one of the most prestigious institutions in the world. And you're just like, yo, there's some sneakers here. And we're looking at things in the future, because the thing is, if we go ahead like 300, 400, 500 years time, what's going to be in the museums then?
It's true. What do you reckon people will be still wearing sneakers in the same way that they wear them now?
Well,
do you reckon they'll be multi-purpose rather than just sports shoes or shoes? Do you reckon like they'll be
tech crepes?
Yeah. Microwave your food. I don't know. I mean, put a little rustlers in your midsole and
maybe it would be the shoes. You know what I mean?
Like a rib sandwich from your midsole. I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? But it could be the shoes. You remember when like Spike Lee as Mars Blackman said, "Is it the shoes?" You know, with the Jordan campaign.
Yeah.
It might actually turn out to be the shoes. You know, levels the playing field. We can all dunk like Jordan.
Yeah. That's true, because they've already, you know, now they've already started. There was a massive sort of a furore over the Eliud Kipchoge, his Nike.
The 4%, exactly.
Yeah. People are saying that those shoes give you an unfair advantage.
I mean, worse
than
that,
they should be banned.
He's still got the natural talent to do it. I mean, if I ran in those 4%, I'd give him a good go. Do you know what I mean?
I was thinking all the people chatting shit going, oh, it gives you an unfair advantage. Okay, you run the marathon in those shoes and see if you could do it in under two hours.
No way.
So funny.
Just chatting breeze.
What was your kind of entry point into into collecting sneakers? Do you remember your first pair or the first pair that made you think, okay, I wanna be a collector. I wanna get these en masse.
Well, I'm not really a collector. I'm more of an accumulator. Some might say a hoarder, but everything has its purpose and a fiscal value. You know, it's an investment for me. But I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, it's all about flexing, just looking hard and wanting to be, you know, the person who's like one-upmanship. You know, in the club. You know, just flossing the best at the end of the day. That's what it came down to. You know, the tenets of hip-hop, which I think we're all familiar here.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same with casual culture as well. You know, the guys on the terraces wanted to flex the best with the rarest Adidas or Diodoras or Sergio Tacchini or whatever they were wearing. You know what I'm saying? It all stems from that. I think one of the first times, though, was Jordan 4s. I was the first dude to get a pair of black Jordan 4s in the country.
Right.
And I remember back in 89, you know, I was just like running around and... I met so many people through those shoes.
Yeah.
I met people through those shoes.
Yeah.
They're met one of my best friends through those shoes.
Aren't they?
Crazy.
They are. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember buying the a JD exclusive Air Max 90 and one of the olders, like one of the most respected olders in their ends, talking to me for the first time because of my trainers and me thinking, I'm a somebody now. I am a somebody. I need to continue this. Yeah. You know what I mean? I need to budget for trainers from now on so that people will talk to me.
That's an icebreaker, isn't it? It's like a lot of commonality. But the mad thing about the sneaker game is that how many people around the world, you know, are into it, and you make friends through kicks, you know, via the Crooked Tongues forum back in the day, or Nike Talk, or whatever, you know, to what's going on now on Instagram and all these events that happen, like Sneakerness, etc. You know, you're just getting people from different parts of the world communicating and loving kicks, and you're just like, whoa. It's a deep thing.
Yeah.
It really is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's just like music. Music transcends, you know, race, barriers, you know, religion, the whole thing. And if we can be a world at peace through kicks,
that'd be nice.
We're in the right place.
That'd be nice. And the two go hand in hand, obviously, music culture, especially hip-hop culture.
Yeah, definitely.
And sneakers, you know, a lot of the time you only wanted a pair of sneakers because they were literally showcased in a music video. I remember the first time I had a mate who didn't know what the Air Force One was called, and he used to just call them those Nikes that 112 wear in that video. And people have been wearing Air Force Ones in videos before this,
but
for some reason it was 112s. I think it was peaches.
Oh my days! Do you remember Montel Jordan and the night and the Darwins?
No,
is the, it, Rod, was, the Rodmans.
Is he wearing them in?
Yeah, he's wearing
this
them in.
Is how we do
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fair play.
Yeah, and his dancers are all wearing them as well, which is kind of crazy.
Just little things like that, you know, not being able
and
to.
And Boyz II Men with the Jordan 11s?
Of course.
Right?
Of course. Yeah.
That was a big look, because that's what Jordan wanted with that shoe. He wanted the pair of shoes that you could wear with a tuxedo.
Right.
Or a tuxedo.
Yeah.
Whatever they say.
Tuxedo.
Well. On that note, really, once everyone's a winner, it is the end of the show.
It is the end of the show with that. Thank you so much to all our guests. Big shout out to Kish, who's in the studio with us right now.
Yeah, it's wicked to be on. Thanks for having us, you know.
Not at all. We'll be back next week. Marcel, Natalie and Michael with loads of new guests, loads of new chat and loads of new music as well.
FUBAR Radio presents
Callum McSwiggan.
the most beautiful person in existence. It's Glyn Fussell.
Hello, Callum.
I once invited a guy over, and I specifically invited him over for sex. I was very honest and upfront about why I was inviting him over.
Which is political, it's very core.
Turned out he was a Tory, and he came over and literally sat on my bed and talked about politics. There was no sex, and then he left, and I was like, I don't understand what's happened. I feel like I've been tricked.
that's what the Tories do. Anything for a vote. Anything for a fucking vote.
Yeah, don't let them trick you on Grindr.
Tories on Grindr. I mean, that's...
Harriet Rose.
Will I Am is joining us on Fubar Radio right now.
There's things that I've done before that I didn't release, like a piece of content that I did with Miley Cyrus that was heavy, and we decided not to put it out.
What do you do with that kind of stuff? Do you hold it in a bank, like, I might put this out one day, or is it like, never again, put it away, we won't see this again?
For the Miley Cyrus one, we got rid of it. It was just too heavy.
You just know, though, don't you?
This one in particular, the Black Eyed Peas one, I know in my heart that it has to come out.
Joey Page.
I'm very excited to welcome Highly Suspect.
Hello.
Into the studio.
Yeah.
Hey,
what's
guys.
Up? Yeah. Yeah, we have what we like to call pre-show poops. It's when you get really juiced up and then all of a sudden you have to poop right before the show.
Is that on your rider? We must have four cubicles available.
We have
pre-show.
Four toilets backstage.
Getting excited for the show, it definitely gets you pumped.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Fubar Radio. Radio presents
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club.
We're joined in the studio now by Morgan McLean. So how did you get involved with Sunday Brunch?
We were up for a Time Out Award for Best Shop in Muswell Hill. Won the award and I was over the moon, drinking the free champagne like no one's business.
Sure.
I go up to the stage, I'm crying so much, I'm so drunk, like so drunk.
Yeah. Like, did you swear?
Yes, we were on television, like I was so nervous.
Yeah.
I got through the segment and Tim went like that on my arm, held my arm, was like, sorry about the swearing. And I was like, shit, did I fucking swear?
Did I fucking swear?
Nick and Nat's fan club. Every Friday from 12 PM.
Fubar Radio.
We're joined in the studio now by head of marketing for the restaurant Sweet Chick, Jasmine Torres.
Yeah.
Is that if I said it
right? Yeah, you said
it
right.
Yes. See? Hello, Jasmine. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm all right.
Jasmine's just said it's your first time on radio.
It's my first time, yeah.
And we're, as you can see, we're
fully professional radio presenters.
It's a bit of a shame. It's a bit of a shame that you started with us, because all other radio shows are going to seem like pieces of shit.
In comparison.
All right, good. So now, Sweet Chick opened in Oxford Circus in September?
Yeah, end of September, beginning of October.
And how's it been?
Yeah, it's been really good. It's we've had a lot of great feedback. We're building our family.
And what is it? What makes so it's fried chicken and waffles, right?
Yeah.
And what makes your chicken different?
It is the best fried chicken you can find. So it started in 2013 in New York by the founder, John Seymour, and Nas was a really big fan. He's a hip-hop guy. And
He
was a big fan of the chicken.
Wasn't involved in the restaurant at that point.
No, not at that point. He was so much of a big fan that he wanted to jump on.
So it's like his local chicken place.
It is his local
and
chicken.
And so, right, so he likes chicken.
Yeah.
Right? And so he goes into this restaurant and he goes, fucking hell, I like chicken. But this is the best chicken I've ever eaten. And I want to put my name on that.
Exactly.
I want to be very much Sweet Chick's Colonel Sanders.
Yeah, exactly that.
Wow.
Say no more.
I mean, that's because there is a lot of fried chicken.
There is a hell of a lot of fried chicken.
And so
there,
to basically be able to go, that is my favourite and I want to stick my name and face on that. I want to stick my face on that.
That's what I say when I have fried chicken.
When I get fried chicken, I want to stick my face on that. but endorse it like that. That's actually really incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, right, so he got involved.
Yeah, and then they opened 4 more spots in the US and decided to bring it overseas to the UK. And, so it is. We opened in 2019.
Is the plan for Sweet Chick to take over the world and be millions of them, or does it want to be smaller than that?
We want to be small. Like, our ethos is to have fun, eat well, and to enjoy yourself, really. Okay. So it's not about world domination. No. It's all about spreading the love and eating well and having fun, really.
And keeping the quality.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
Chicken and waffles, so it's a pre-existing thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I have heard this, but is that like a big thing in the States before?
Yeah.
Chicken and waffles?
It actually originated in New York as well, so it's a big, big thing.
Why, though?
Why chicken and waffles?
Have you tried combo?
I've had chicken and waffles, yeah. I had chicken and waffles all the way back in 2010. Guys,
that's even before Nas had it.
You've literally just heard of it, and I've been
a decade in.
I've been eating. I think it's okay. Right. So, just to talk about it, rather than the fact that it's a product and you are working for this restaurant, just to talk about it in terms of getting your head around it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, chicken has bones in it, right? And waffles are sweet and soft. And chicken. That's the thing I can't really get my head around is the fact that you can't just sort of like get some chicken and put it in a waffle and then eat it all. It's kind of like there's bones and stuff involved.
We've got like there's a waffle, a fried chicken waffle sandwich, no bones, no nothing. Bones. You can just go straight in.
What? You still have it together?
Yeah.
So hang on.
You were thinking like you have some fried chicken and then you have dessert, which is a waffle.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You've got it on the same plate.
Mm-hmm.
You sound like a little bit like a 1970s Blue Peter presenter.
I know I do.
Who's just heard about barbecue sauce.
I do realise like I'm like, what's he called? The bloke from Strictly who does that show with Aisy Harriott where
Len Wiseman.
Len Goodman
did the Underworld films.
Yeah. Len Goodman. So you'd have it on the same plate as, and the waffles are sweet, right?
Yeah.
Sweet and you're waffles. Having that with maple syrup and
cream. Do you do it with
no, not with cream. We've got like different types of butter, like a lemon butter, a raspberry butter, or a normal butter, depending on what butter.
Normal butter now. Amazing.
So let's say you've got them both on the same plate.
I just want to say I'm on board, and I think this sounds delicious.
I think it's gonna be delicious, but I'm getting my head around it. Okay, so you got your chicken. Are you eating your chicken first?
It's Valerie Singleton.
You're having a little bit of waffle while you're having your chicken.
Yeah. Together.
Well, I never.
Mind blowing.
It is mind blowing. So it's your sweet and your savoury together.
Indeed. Yeah, but come on, right. Okay, so let's just... okay, so if you were to have some barbecue chicken...
Sure.
Right, that would be chicken with sort of a sweet glaze on it, right?
For sure.
And you can have honey glazed chicken and all okay. this. So it's not a new thing to combine okay. savoury with sweet, right?
No.
And so all this is instead of like having French fries mm-hmm. or mashed potato,
sure.
what you're doing is as an accompaniment to your chicken is you've got a waffle.
Yeah. It's and we're talking about the sweet waffle. We're not talking about a bird's eye potato waffle, which would make sense.
Which would make sense.
It makes sense.
A Belgian style.
A Belgian style waffle made for waffle irons and all that.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Okay. They're waffly versatile.
Are you sure?
So, okay. And do you eat there?
Oh, of course I do.
But not every day.
At the moment, I have eaten there every day.
Oh, right.
Because yeah. you can't leave.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good, you know. We don't just do waffle chicken and waffles. So
no, sure.
Luckily.
So currently, you've been there a while. You're eating there every day.
Yeah.
Is the waffle chicken combination freaking you out still? Are you got used to it?
I'm totally used to
okay.
it.
Okay, so that's how it takes. So you opened in October. It's now the end of January, so we're saying 3 months, that's all you eat. That's when you start going, okay. All right, I get it now. That's when it stops being novel.
Exactly.
Right, okay. Okay, I've got it. I'm just going to eat it for 3 months and then I won't be like, what? It's pudding and main course in one.
It is.
But normally when you eat like the same stuff every day, you get bored of it, don't you? But this is almost like Stockholm Syndrome. Yeah. Where now you love the chicken and the waffles. That's my point. I'm gonna
So do you have
I've been accused of talking too much. which I think is a bit weird considering it's my radio show.
It's our radio show.
You're, yeah, my co-host. No, it's our
okay, I'm here
show.
To tell the listeners about the combination of waffles and chicken. It's a new idea for people. I'm trying to
no, sure.
feed it to the.
You're
the
like that awesome. That guy in Hellboy who joins the organisation. You're like
yes.
the eyes
yes,
of the
that's
audience.
It. I'm the eyes of the audience. I'm the mouth of the audience in this case.
Where me and Jasmine, we know all about
you're
chicken.
You're in the
and
BPRD.
Waffles.
You've been there a while.
Sure.
I'm Will Smith in the Men in Black franchise. Mm. I'm coming into it. It's already going off. They're already dealing with aliens.
Yeah.
And I have to present them and introduce the audience to the concept that this covert government agency.
Yeah, you're Tommy Lee Jones and I'm Rip Torn.
That's right. In this sequence, but it's about sweet chick chicken. Oh, sweet chick. I've just got it. Just got it. The waffle sweet. The chick is a chicken. Sweet chick.
Yeah.
Got it.
Fucking hell. Hey, it's lovely of you to come in.
It's a pleasure.
So it says here that so you got the American. It's an American company.
Yeah.
You come over to England. and come over to England, taking our chicken dress. come over to England, and you've like anglicised it slightly. There's kind of like things that you've kind of incorporated a British, slightly British. I don't know why you'd do that. The reason we like restaurants from other countries is to get away from British food.
FUBAR Radio presents
Harriet Rose.
I'm joined by the wonderful Ray Black. I woke up to my mum listening to my music and singing along to it. And there's one that's like, it's very explicit. And she was singing along and vibing to it. And
oh,
I was like
yeah.
to my sister in the next room, like, oh my God, I can't believe she's listening to this song. Like, this song is about sex. She waltzes into the room and she's like, there's nothing you're doing that I haven't done before. I was like, oh my God.
So we're all learning new things.
There's nothing you're singing about I haven't done before. So it's fine.
Oh my God.
Harriet Rose, every Thursday from 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
I am now joined by the Mowgli's. Josh and Katie are here.
Hello.
How are you guys?
We are so great, actually.
Are you tired? Because you've been, I know you're on your UK tour right now, so things are pretty hectic.
I think we're running on adrenaline.
Yeah, pure adrenaline, actually.
You're just going to pass out at the end?
Yes.
Probably.
Which
yeah.
is fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fine. We'll just push it and push it and push it until there's nothing left, and then we'll sleep for like 4 days straight.
Which is, honestly, that sounds so fun.
Oh, it
Thank
does.
You. I
so,
think
so,
so too.
Fun. Right, let's talk about music. American Feelings.
Yes.
Is this your latest EP? Yes. And it's sort of you guys, well, it's self-explanatory, really, like kind of inwardly looking about your feelings and emotions. And I think you guys have always done that in terms of you kind of talk about your life and your experiences in a very honest way with your music. But I wanted to ask first is like, how does that differ for you guys from Waiting for the Dawn? Because it's like, obviously you guys have been together a long time and the progression of the band, how do you feel as the band in that trajectory, in that change? Do you feel different? Do you feel like the same people? Like, what's it kind of feel like now you're touring the UK and you're kind of doing this EP now? How does it feel?
Yeah, I would say we've grown so much as human individuals, and
part of that growth was from Waiting for the Dawn.
Yeah, it's true. And we came out with that first record and we were so optimistic, and not that we're not optimistic anymore, but you know, we definitely over time have tried to dig a little deeper. And every song can't just be like about happiness and sunshine, you know.
It would be dishonest.
It's important to dig deep and be honest, and
I think people
connect with that.
Mm-hmm. We actually got to write one of those songs with here in London.
Oh yeah, that's true.
With a few British lads, and that was a really cool experience. And the whole experience was very introspective. I think we were kind of just writing a collection of songs. We tend to write and we put all the songs into this file, and then at some point we sat down and we listened to all the songs and we were discussing what we were going to put out, and the four songs that were on American Feelings just all stood apart separately and also kind of worked as a package. They're all discussing different things, but there's this common theme of introspection and personal experience, you know, in today's day and age and in the culture that we wrote it in and live in. And there was just this thread that made them all work sense together, or make sense together for some reason. I don't know.
But I feel like that's a connection that only you guys can create and then we get to enjoy, because it's like once you're in the studio and you've obviously been, you know, together, you know each other so well. I mean, that's so important, I think.
Yeah. Yes.
That you just know what to do and where to go with each music. And I wanted to talk in terms of like, because I know you guys have spoken about like mental health and how difficult it is to tour, and like you say, when you release your first album and the way what it's like and the industry and what everyone says to you and how it all works, how do you think you guys have stayed together and been strong for so long? Like, what is the secret? Because I mean, not that there's one specific secret, but I think it's something good to talk about in terms of mental health in the music industry.
I think that there's so many times in an artist's life where it would be easy to throw your hands up and give up. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of artists have done that right before things could have turned around for them. But I just think that at the end of the day, resilience is so important in your art and in your personal life. Like, to be able to just continue getting up in the morning and know that even in the darkest times, even in the strangest of times, like trusting and having faith that there is that light at the end of the tunnel, that something will pay off, that your hard work will, you know, see some kind of benefit. It can be so, so hard to do. But I think that if you can tap into that personal resilience, especially as an artist, I mean, it seems so easy to want to throw in the towel sometimes. And, you know, just for your pride's sake to say, you know, fuck it, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's a little bit harder to keep going, but if you can tap into that and you can keep doing it, I found that every time we've done that, which is, you know, how we've ended up here, it's been worth it in the end. And so I think that's really it, is it's not that we haven't seen lows, and it's not that we haven't had obstacles or hit walls. It's that every time that's happened, we've just made a choice to push through. And that it's how we got here. You know, we've been trying to get overseas for so, so long. And I think over the past few years, there have been a number of walls that we've hit. And we've thought, like, maybe we just throw in the towel. Maybe it's time to turn around and try something new. And we just we pushed through for whatever reason, and I'm so glad we did, because now we've gotten to come over to the UK and we've gotten to bring our message across the Atlantic, and
here you are, like,
music. Here we are.
That's
this is
the answer. You literally wanted to achieve something and you achieved it, and
it's
that's
a dream come true, really.
And that is the funny thing about that. Like, I was just going to link to the Wasting Time video, which I love, by
Thank
the way.
You.
It's nice. Really beautiful, but it's so similar to that, because for those of you who haven't seen it, the storyline is like a couple who have clearly broken up, and it's kind of the story of the aftermath and the kind of memories and the sadness.
It can be so hard.
And then that day where you realize, it's like, that is a metaphor for everything. It's like, they're on that worst possible day when you're having the worst day ever, you know that there are better days coming. You know that there's something else coming. And I think that's such an important message. It's like, because when you're in that moment, you're like, no, nothing good's going to happen. It's awful. Everything's awful. It's like, well, actually, there is that light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And I think that hopefully, like, we are able to provide that reminder to people, and not only provide that reminder to other people, but to provide that reminder to ourselves. You know, it's we need that message. We need every message we put out as much as anybody else needs it. And so to remind ourselves, hey, when it looks dark, when it looks like it's bad, when we feel like we should give up, hang on, you're not alone, you've got this. You know, it's served us really, really well. And hopefully that message reverberates and it makes it to other people who need it as well.
I absolutely, yeah. When I watched it, I was like, it's a really funny thing, because I've recently, you know, you go through bad times and whatever, and good times in other ways and bad times in other ways. And this morning I was hungover.
Whew, been there.
Been there, babes. And I was like, God, I feel like I want to die. And then by 3 o'clock, I'd gone to the gym and I'd eaten something really nice. And I'd watched your video like 4 times. And I was like, hey, do you remember earlier through. When you literally wanted to die? And now you feel great. And it's like, exactly. When you feel good after feeling bad, it's like, remember that feeling of being like, oh, remember when you felt really bad like 10 minutes ago? Now you
100%.
Feel great.
And I know for me, like, when I get depressed or when I'm hungover or when I'm sick, like, in that moment, and he can attest because he lives with me, I truly, like, in those moments, I just feel like this is it forever. Like, this is how I feel
we
now.
We all do.
Forever.
We all do.
And yeah, I mean, I think that every time you do push through and you get to that place where you feel better, it makes it that much easier next time to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
And when you think about it, and you remind yourself of that when you're feeling good, that's the best.
Yeah, it's
you're
the best.
You're ace. You just made yourself feel good.
You proved something to yourself. I think that's so massive, too, to be able to, like, get through something and just say, like, wow, I did that.
Yeah.
I did that. And knowing that you're capable of getting through that hangover, it'll get you through the next one.
Yep. Boom!
Yep.
Josh and Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck tonight.
Thank you for talking with us. Thank you for hanging out. This has been
great. It's a pleasure to have you. When you come back, the next tour you do, get back in the studio, please.
Absolutely.
And obviously, we're going to have to take you out of the studio for pints.
OMG.
Okay. Yes. I love it.
I am pinting all over the place with you. FUBAR Radio presents Callum McSwiggan.
Today, I'm joined in the studio by the gorgeous, the beautiful, the brightly pink-haired, it's Ruby Rare. Sometimes discriminating against bisexual people. It's more from gay people. There's so much, you know, bi erasure, people saying it doesn't exist, and so much of that comes from the gay community. And I don't really know why that is. It's worrying, really.
I've had people that I was seeing question my sexuality when I'm like, babe, we're, like, fucking all the time. What do I need to prove to you that I enjoy having sex with you?
What more can I do?
I'm like, literally, we are in bed. My head is in between your legs. Like, I don't know what else I can do to prove this.
Every Wednesday. Callum McSwiggan. From 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Today, I am joined by the absolutely gorgeous, the stunning. It's Jack Guinness.
Good. I'm glad they can't see me, so I can just pretend that I'm gorgeous.
You are gorgeous.
Well, I had a night out last night. I'm not looking 100%. I feel great.
I wouldn't have known to look at you. You look fresh and ready.
That's my Irish genes.
Let's talk about the queer Bible.
Yes.
So you started this a few years ago, I think in 2017.
Yeah, good. You know better than I do. Yeah, it started because I was watching the Oscars, and it was the year when Sam Smith won an Oscar for Best Song, and they said that they were the first gay person to win an Oscar.
Yes.
And that turned out not to be true. And they got destroyed on Twitter, and people being so mean to Sam.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, where would one go to find that? Where would one go? Where do you go to find out that kind of history? Like, there isn't really a resource. So I looked online, and all the websites were like, really, they looked like they were made in the 90s on, like, you know, Microsoft Word clip art. And they were just really academic, really boring. They weren't engaging. And I was like, well, the LGBTQ plus community are the most creative, fabulous, brilliant people ever. So they need a space that looks and feels like that, that has the same energy. So I created the Queer Bible. So really simply, it's little essays where I ask my heroes to write about their heroes. And then I get an amazing young LGBTQ plus artist, illustrator, to do an original illustration with it. So it looks beautiful. It has a really lovely feel. And it's not about me at all. It's not about, you know, I've been a model for 10, 15 years now, and everything's about like me and selling stuff. And this is a space for other people. Yeah. It's a space for other people to tell their stories in their own voices. You know, I'm a privileged cis white man, a gay man, and I think those kinds of people have controlled the narrative a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And
kind of said what's important and what isn't important. So this is an opportunity for me to create a framework to empower and enable other people to tell their stories, and then I step back. So it's, you know, I can do better in terms of diversity, but I'm really proud of the breadth of voices that we have on the site. And they're just, some of the essays are hilarious and will just make you wet yourself. Some of them make you cry your eyes out. Some of them are shocking. The essay on Robert Mapplethorpe, the amazing photographer, I tracked down one of his ex-boyfriends, and he wrote about the day when he got really wasted. He's about 17. He was beautiful. He went to the Chelsea Hotel. He met a young woman called Patti Smith and her boyfriend, Robert Mapplethorpe, and promptly steals Robert off Patti Smith. So if you don't know who Robert Mapplethorpe is, you're like, whoa, this is a fucking brilliant story. And if you do know who he is, you get this untold history, basically, that no one knows about. So that's the kind of gist of the Queer Bible.
I love that. And I think it's a really special moment in every queer person's life where they kind of make that leap from that feeling of like, I don't belong and I feel weird and I feel strange, to suddenly realizing, no, actually, this is a gift and I'm part of something really, really incredible.
Where was yours? Did you meet a group of people?
Yeah, I did. So for me, I finished regular school and I went on to like sixth form at a completely different place. And I went from a school where there was absolutely not a single out LGBT plus person.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly went to this new school and I took music there. And there was eight of us in my music class.
The music class is the place to go,
gay.
Isn't it?
Hi, boys. We were all gay, every last one of us. And suddenly I was like, oh, wow, like there are other people. And they all knew each other. They were all friends and they were all extremely gay.
You're so lucky.
I was lucky to get that at 16, because some people, you know, they don't get that into their 20s, 30s, even later in life.
I ran away to New York when I was 17 and met a rather fun gang of people. And that was, and also I think because it wasn't London, I grew up in central London, and I think going to somewhere completely different made me feel like I could be completely different and be who I really wanted to be.
That's quite a leap at 17 to run away to New York.
Yeah, I was a bit wild.
Yeah, no, I love that though.
But it was fun.
Yeah.
And plus the accent really helped me.
But I also understood, maybe I have this wrong, that you didn't come out until later in life.
So I'd always been out to all my friends.
Yes.
And, you know, if you meet me, I can't really hide it. It's pretty obvious. But with my family and in the modelling industry, I wasn't. And especially in my career, it's weird because you think of the fashion industry as a super gay industry, and it is in many ways. But it also, now it's changed. It's in the last few years, really quickly, it's really accepted kind of gender diversity and non-binary. And, but then it wasn't so much like that. And I've got a beard, and the kind of clothes that I was selling and the kinds of brands I was working with wanted a very particular type of masculinity. They wanted quite like a heteronormative vibe. And because I looked like that anyway, I was encouraged basically by my agency to not talk about being gay, to, you know, slightly police my physicality and how I talk and stuff on shoot. So I'd go in and sound like a complete creep like, hey, And that was horrible because it was like, you kind of come to terms with yourself and then you have to go back in the closet again. So that was a bit of a head fuck.
Yeah.
But now, weirdly, like when I came out and I did an interview with The Guardian when we launched the Queer Bible, and I came out and I was told, you know, you're going to lose some clients, you're going to lose some contracts, which is mad to think that still happens. Yeah. But the first campaign I booked after I came out was a Levi's Pride campaign.
Oh, wow.
So I was the face of Levi's because I was gay.
Yes.
So instead of losing jobs, which was my fear, and maybe, you know, I should have come out earlier, and I think about that a lot, that I didn't. But now I am out, I'm really grateful that I get to represent our community.
I actually had no idea that this was something that existed in the modelling world, because I've heard of it happening in, you know, the world of sport, the world of music, where people are encouraged to, you know, keep it quiet, not tell anybody. But I didn't know that went beyond into modelling, and I'm sure it goes again further into other industries out there.
I mean, the acting industry is a big one. I remember I trained as an actor years ago, and I'd go and meet agents, and I'll never forget one agent sat down and said, look, you've got two options for careers. You can be the leading man and you can be in the closet, or you can be gay and you'll be a character actor and play the best friend. Mm. And that was just so depressing to hear. And these are supposed to be the enlightened artistic industries. And I've got some gay friends that are actors, and some of them are out, and some of them are in the closet. And it's interesting seeing their journeys. I think things are changing really quickly.
Yeah.
It does make me really, really proud. We've got some amazing people that are really at the forefront of changing things. And we've got brilliant TV shows like Pose and stuff that are much more representative and inclusive. So things are changing. But also, I don't judge other people. Like, we're all on our journeys. Like, you need to do what's right for you at the time that's right for you as well. You know, if someone doesn't feel safe to come out for whatever reason...
Yeah, I absolutely never think that it's the individual's fault. I think we see a lot of unfair criticism thrown at people who stay in the closet for whatever reason. That's that person's choice.
Exactly.
And they don't owe coming out to anyone, not a single soul do they owe that to. But my issue is with the industry as a whole and how it's creating an environment where that is the case. But it's also lovely to hear, you know, that you did publicly
and it's so positive, and I've been loving it, and now I, you know, I've worked for a really long time in the fashion industry, and now I'm really excited about this kind of next phase of my career, which is kind of sharing queer stories and queer history.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
FUBAR Radio presents Joey Page.
Mini mentions, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Can I get you to just do a little... Can you just advertise the show quickly for us?
Joe Page is kind of tight.
Joe Page is my real name. I've added a showbiz Y.
That's right. Why would you do that? Oh, Joe Page.
It's too late now.
I think you should drop the Y.
Yeah.
Joe Page suits the mustache, too.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Joe Page.
Turn the page, sick. Joe.
And the suit. Yeah, I think Joe, man.
Joe Page!
I've already done...
Joe Page.
Made a lot of posters with Joey Page on.
Hey, this is Michael from Mini Mansions, and you're listening to Joe Page. Page on FUBAR Radio every Wednesday, 2 p.m.
And I'm very excited to be talking to Kelsey and Nick from Local Natives. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Letterman was fun. I had an interesting situation at the end of our set. He's like, oh, where are you guys from? And here, I'll go over here so, like, it makes sense. So I was just like, Silver Lake! He's like, cool, thanks. And then he leaves.
Maybe to make you feel better, we'll do the reverse. So I'm going to get you to ask me where I'm from.
Yeah, but where are you from?
Bexley Heath! Bro, you got to represent where you're from.
Yeah.
John Grant, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Joey.
Do you feel you are appreciated enough in the music business? You're like a genius in music, so...
Thank you for the fantastic compliments. I don't feel particularly great at what I do, so it's always nice to hear that. I don't know, I don't feel like I'm allowed to have an opinion about that. I think I'm probably getting what I can handle. I wonder if I would be able to take the kind of attention that some people get.
Band of Skulls, welcome into...
Thank you very much.
Russell and Emma, how are you doing? I'm sure you were far too busy to be aware of this, but it was pancake day. How are your pancaking skills? Are you any good at making them? Are you any good at flipping them?
I do a good American pancake.
Baking soda?
Dad's recipe. It's amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's the secret, though, isn't it, to make them rise?
In the fridge for a bit, just to chill.
That's an extra thing that will help me next time I make them.
Every Wednesday from 2 p.m.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
I would say that I'm excited to welcome my first guest of the afternoon. It's Josh, the mastermind behind Alex Chilltown. Welcome to the show, Josh. How are you doing?
I am good. I had a pretty good journey here. I saw someone who looked like Jimmy Nail on the bus.
Did you? Oh, well, I tell you what, never has there been a better opening gambit to an interview than that. Because, right, I once saw Suggs on the Overground.
Sounds like madness.
Very good. And I was almost certain that it was him, right? Mm. And I thought, I wonder, does Suggs have an Oyster or a paper ticket? So I followed him up and I lost sight of him. But But I'll never know. I'm almost certain it was him. So how much of you, percentage-wise, did you think might have been Jimmy Nail? Or was it just like, there's no way?
It was about 20 years too young.
Right,
it was,
okay.
It was so definitely that. Like, the time machines have been invented in the universe that Jimmy Nail lives in, which is this one, I guess.
Well, I don't know. When was the last time you saw him?
That is true. Maybe Jimmy Nail is a time traveller.
I mean, if you'd produced the kind of music that Jimmy Nail had produced, maybe you would go back and come back as a different person a bit later on.
Yeah.
But why did you decide to, and I think it's a brilliant title and very striking and really grabs your attention, but why Eulogies for the album?
It was kind of like one of the first songs that we wrote. Eulogies is the first track on the album, but it's like, I always try and look at what I'm doing instinctively and then try and work out why I did it, because I think that kind of leads you to where you can go next. And it's kind of like, I think maybe because I was kind of moving on and going somewhere else, it's kind of like Eulogies, this is kind of the end of something and then the start of something new. And it's kind of like, I really like that as kind of an image.
Yeah, right. It feels like a very personal and like very kind of weighty connotations to it. Like you've like really immersed yourself in the world that you're writing about and making music about. So why did you decide that you wanted to work within the confines of Croydon? Because obviously it must be really difficult to work out what you want to base a whole album's worth of stuff on, but what was it about the sort of closeness and the claustrophobia of Croydon that really grabbed you?
I think it's just like a kind of like growing up on like David Bowie and stuff and like the concept albums and stuff. And I know Bowie hated Croydon very famously. But like as well, like I was listening to an interview with someone and apparently there's a really good quote from Brian Eno where he said something like, pop music isn't like making music in the traditional form. It's more like building a world and then inviting people in.
Yeah.
And I found, so like Croydon kind of like as a concrete claustrophobic place is like a really good space for that, because it is this kind of natural world that you can kind of like highlight.
Because I don't know if I'm explaining it so well, but for people that have not been there, it does have a very foreboding feel. Like it feels a very unfriendly place, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very much like, it's hard to describe because it is just Croydon. It's like a case of like, I don't know, yeah, it's very like, you have to kind of experience it. It's got, even though it's not quite London and it's not quite Surrey, it's just kind of its own. And it has like a very specific kind of like visual language, I guess. And it's like lots of
concrete. It's like got quite harsh architecture and stuff. And I think, you know, like there's a lot of big flyovers and a lot of concrete everywhere, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so an academic concept that I'm really interested in, which I kind of think hangs over the record, is the concept of hauntology. So the idea of hauntology is it's like ghosts of the future. So it's like the way I would imagine it is like, you're looking at like a building that was built in the 60s that was meant to kind of formulate a future that never quite came.
Yeah, right.
And Croydon's full of those kind of like big 60s redevelopments. This is what the future's going to be. And then
yeah, this was it look like and then it never gets there. That's really cool, actually. It sounds like a very complicated subject to like look into. But have you read it? Like, was there something that sparked your interest in that initially that an idiot like myself might be able to go, I'm going to read about that?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in like, I really like good music journalism.
Right. I'm sorry about that.
And so, like, people like Mark Fisher. So Mark Fisher had a blog called K-Punk.
Right.
So he's written, like, lots of stuff about music, and he wrote lots about Susie and the Banshees and Roxy Music and stuff like that. So Mark Fisher was kind of one of the people who popularised hauntology. And then, like, Simon Reynolds as well. So Simon Reynolds has written, like, lots of really good books on, like, post-punk, and it's called, like, Rip It Up and Start Again. It's kind of like back in the glory days of the NME, maybe in the 80s, where it was like this thing of like, it wasn't just music, it was kind of cultural criticism. Really was kind of on the kind of like avant-garde of what was happening kind of culturally and musically.
Yeah, and it's such a thing that's missing. I mean, it's definitely there in like a lot of elements of grime, but like that sort of social side of it is really missing, I think, a lot in today's music. And not necessarily the music, but the way that it's portrayed by the media. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you can't really divorce it, I think, from the kind of socioeconomic, not to get too heavy, but the socioeconomic climate of what's happening and like the way like different music has shifted culturally.
Mm.
And I think that kind of like maybe a lot of guitar music has become more middle class, whereas like sort of like grime and other music is based in like specific working class cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
So it kind of has this kind of more sort of like, yeah, more like kind of working class, and it's kind of like it's a bit more oppositional, a bit more like,
yeah, yeah,
wants to make a change to the world.
Yeah, 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 totally. I'm gonna recommend a book to you actually, if you don't mind, because I think it's something that you'd really enjoy. There's a guest I had on here a few months back called Tim Mohr, which is M-O-H-R, and he went to Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall and like basically told the story of all the punks that helped bring down the Berlin Wall, and it's such an amazing book.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's really great, and he was a really, really interesting guy to talk to. But the book, I've been reading it, and it's absolutely amazing. So yeah, I highly recommend that to you. I can't remember what it's called. Maybe Abby, you can dig up. What was Tim's book called? Can you remember? Burning Down the House, but H-A-U-S, because that's German.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to play Barely Awake. So tell us a bit about that track specifically, Josh.
Yeah, so that was kind of like, that's one that's kind of been lingering around for a few years. It was just kind of basically a very, how do I describe it? A very short, intense relationship that was very short, but very like...
Left a mark.
Yeah, at the time, yeah, it was just kind of, it was kind of like, you know, when you just meet someone out of the blue and then it just like, just go on a very short whirlwind and then it kind of all sort of like ends as quickly as it started and then you're just kind of like, what happened there? And then it's like, yeah.
And where did they come from? Where did they go?
Yeah.
Are they coming back?
You're listening to Foo Bar Radio.